Hi everyone, and thanks for joining us on Lit Radio podcast. I'm Thea, and today I'm joined by Kevin Mark Watts, author of the 10-Minute Rules, a mindset for creating winning teams in business. Kevin has over 30 years of experience in roles spanning retail operations, HR director, and commercial director at Crystal Palace Football Club. Today, he mentors business leaders and designs team-building strategies for organizations within the small and medium-sized enterprise sector. The 10-Minute Rules proposes a practical and accessible framework for entrepreneurs and leaders seeking to cultivate a highly charged business with a powerhouse of people. Hi, Kevin. It's a great pleasure to welcome you on the Lit Radio podcast. I'm very excited to speak with you about your book. But first of all, how are you?
I'm not bad, thanks. And thanks for the welcome. Yeah, very well. Thank you. Hope all's well your end.
Yeah. Okay, so before we talk about the book, could you share with our listeners a little bit about your background? Because you have a very interesting, varied background and obviously how that led you to the book.
Sure. Okay. I think for me, where do we start? I think the best place to start is at 17 years of age. I walked out of college, really, which is not a great start, is it? But I walked out of college in the middle of my A-levels. I'd had a bit of a tumultuous education, to be honest. And that goes back to when I failed or didn't pass my 11 plus. And back in the 1970s, it was a very binary education system. You'll have heard, probably heard many other people say that. And they kind of categorized you as to those who passed the 11 plus went to grammar school and they were studying. In those days, banking was very much the nuance, but also law and medical professions and the like. And if you didn't make that, then they would siphon you off to a secondary modern, as they were then known. And that was much more about teaching trades and working in industry from a trade perspective. And quite frankly, I didn't feel like I fitted in either of those things, but I didn't really know why. So I didn't have a very good secondary education. I struggled through my GCSEs. They were O-levels then. And then I went to college to do my A-levels to see if I could jumpstart my interest in academic studies. 9 months into that, I realised that wasn't working either. So I just went down the job centre. I got myself a job in a men's retail store selling high-class made-to-measure suits, would you believe? And as soon as I got that job and I started selling and realised that I could actually sell, I had a little bit of the gift of the gab. My boss, Ray Finney, taught me how to sell suits. And goodness me, it was like my world changed overnight. So suddenly I realised where my niche clearly fitted in that sort of commerce area, which they didn't really teach much about at schools. Had a fantastic retail career. It went on for 20 years in that guise. And I went through area management, regional operational management. I ended up at head office for the last 6 years of those 20 years, and I was in senior management roles there. I did a lot of work on recruitment, retail support areas. And then finally, I got my first HR manager's job. It was across 7,000 people over 700 odd stores. It was a fantastic opportunity. That then came to a bit of an abrupt end when there was a merger and acquisition of the business with another business. So I wasn't really on the right side of the fence for that. So I got made redundant. I went to work for a guy called Simon Jordan. And that was interesting because at that time, he was a retail magnate. He was operating about 160 to 200 mobile phone stores. And mobile phones in the late 90s was a big growth area. And I went as his HR manager. But 7 months into that, he sold that business to what is now known as T-Mobile. And he went and bought Crystal Palace Football Club. So there was this really strange sort of turn left of my career into a completely new world of football, where I spent 10 years at Crystal Palace Football Club, starting off as the HR manager, moving into board directorship, and a bit of HR, a lot of commercial directorship there. And I had a really good 10 years at the football club. Football is a strange industry, though. it's very at the front end, it's all glitz and glamour and expensive footballers and so on and so forth. Behind that, there's almost a bust business. Very, very distraught cash flow constraints, and very difficult to manage, and a relatively small workforce, would you believe? So it was a really strange environment. That came to an end in 2010, and that's when I started my entrepreneurial journey. Set up a business. I wanted to stay in the sports sector, so I set up a business in community sports, going into primary schools, teaching physical education to children aged between 5 and 12. Fantastic 12 years of my life. I learned probably as much about business in those 12 years, despite my fairly extensive corporate career, but actually doing it on the ground and licking stamps, putting them on envelopes, going back to that world. And, you know, it really was an interesting journey. But post-lockdown, things changed during those 2 years, as we'll all remember. It needed the impetus to go again. I was approaching 60 years of age, and I thought, to do this business justice, I need to sell it to someone who's going to nurture it and care for it to take it to another level. So I sold the business for a very substantial return post-lockdown. And since then, it's a very long answer to your question. Sorry, Taya. But since then, I ended up entering the world of business mentorship. I work for the Associated Business Mentors on their Help to Grow scheme. I work in the SME sector. I sit on businesses, management meetings as a non-exec director role. And I really enjoy it. So I felt that I wanted to expand on that. So I created a program called a 10-pillar program, and we're going to come on to that shortly. And that evolved into what is now a book.
Well, fascinating. It's a long answer, but I think otherwise you can't really
Have to get it all in.
Yeah, share everything. Yeah, no, well, you definitely have some very interesting experience, and a lot, you've been on so many different positions, and I'm sure you've learned a lot from each of them. And of course, as you said, that's now translated into a book, which is titled The 10-Minute Rules. So could you tell us a little bit more about why you decided to write it?
Why did I decide to write the book? I suppose there are two strands to that answer, and I'll try and keep this a little bit shorter this time. But there are two strands to that. I think the first one is we get great life lessons out of adversity, and I wanted to share that journey, especially for people who are in their first leadership role in business. It could be a corporate structure, or if they're running their own business. And I wanted to share those stories about how adversity feeds life lessons that really help us to become much better versions of ourselves. And I think the second strand of that was that I saw a gap in the market for what I'm now delivering. In terms of adversity, I mean, I'd been made redundant twice in my career, and they both served me very, very well. So redundancy isn't a dismal sin. It's not always the end of the journey. And I also got sacked from my first area manager role while I was learning on the job. It was the first time that I'd gone into what effectively was real multi-site retail management, where I was managing people at a distance, not always in my own individual environment, if you know what I mean, on the same shop floor or whatever you would call that in your world. And I struggled with that very badly, and I actually got sacked from it. Fortunately for me, a business mentor, a regional director, got hold of me and managed to turn that situation around. So I've had those experiences as well. Coming out of Crystal Palace Football Club wasn't a very enjoyable experience. The last 6 months, we went back into business administration, so insolvency processes, and I left that as a second redundancy as well, although I knew that was always going to happen because I was part of the Jordan, Simon Jordan dynasty. Yeah, I've had lots of adversity in my journey, and I've always realised that out of that, I've come out of the other side having learned lots of lessons and become a better person for it, even as an entrepreneur running my own business. On the one hand, I'm winning awards, South London Best New Business Award in 2012. We achieved that in 18 months from the launch of the business. A week later, I'm almost bust. I'm almost insolvent again because I'd pushed the marketing strategies that had worked the previous year. It didn't work. I had too many staff on board. I didn't have enough cash. I was a young business. So I went from winning an award to effectively the next week, almost facing insolvency, and I had to dig deep, put more money into the black hole and go again. And that worked out very well in the end as well. So I think that's where my adversity lessons and teaching great life lessons come from. But the realization as well that in the business world, when I was running my own business, as I was starting to grow the business and the team was getting wider, I realized that I needed some more corporate structure into the business. And there's varying degrees of thought leadership or thought experts out there on aspects of running a business. Generally, there's quite a lot about operating systems in business and bringing blue chip corporate operating systems into small business environment. There's also a plethora of stuff out there about leadership mindset. I mean, you could probably fill a book, you could probably fill your bookshelf with just leadership books and still don't have enough space. And then there was this other angle, which we're going to talk about, I think, a little bit later in one of your questions about performance analysis and self-improvement. So I wanted to fuse those three things together and put it in one place so that somebody who's in their first leadership role and facing these challenges or running their own business, they could pick this tool up and it would give them a rounded perspective and solution for the challenges that they're facing.
Yeah, really fascinating. I think it's very interesting how you're talking about obviously facing a lot of failures, but well, that wasn't the end of the world. That taught you a lot, and so obviously that's what you share in the book, which I find quite interesting, and obviously because it comes from a deeply personal experience, Kevin, which is great. But before we talk more about what's in the book, and because this is a book podcast, could you share with us what was the writing process for you? What was it like to write a book?
Yeah, it's interesting. It was my wife. I mean, I 18 months ago, I was writing a 10-pillar training program, as I alluded to just a little bit earlier. And my wife said to me, "But that's a book, isn't it?" And I went, I'm not sure. Writing a book? Anyway, October came. I had a little bit of spare time. So I thought, let me just write a few chapters and see how it goes. So I started that process. Actually, the structural side of it to begin with was quite easy because it was coming from a place that I already had, which was this 10-pillar program, hence the 10-10-minute rules. So the structural side of it in terms of getting the framework of the book down was very easy. And actually, although I had a very difficult academic time, one thing I was always good at, the only thing I was pleased my parents were going to parents' evening for was the English teacher, because I enjoy English and I enjoy writing. So that was actually quite easy as well. One of the most enjoyable aspects of it was the research, because I was now looking for thought leaders who were going to be able to validate and endorse the things that I was saying. Because I personally believe that people aren't necessarily always just interested in what Kevin Mark Watts has got to say. They're more interested in how that works in as a rounded perspective. So I very much wanted to bring in a lot of thought leaders into the book to create that rounded perspective to say, look, this stuff's out here. You know, and I can point you to that in the bibliography and so on and so forth. So that research into those thought leaders was fascinating, because just having that validation, if you like, that I was on the right path, I was on the right process. And then the hardest bit was working with Lyd, but working with Lyd equally was probably one of the most enjoyable experiences of my last probably 15, 20 years. Fantastic team you've got there. And I know you know that, Taya. So much thanks to Ayana for the construct edit, to Brian for the copy edit, and the great artwork and stuff that came into it from Caroline. And then, of course, I've got Alec giving me in my ear advice, and Martin as well. Fantastic team to be able to work to. But the structural edit I found was the hardest bit, because it made it a much more polished end product. And I completely appreciated that. In fact, valued it immensely, but it was hard work going through that. And I don't think, I certainly didn't realise how much work. I thought, send the book off to the publisher, that's it, gone in the post. Sit back and relax and wait for the book to be printed. Lots of work, isn't there, as you well know. But it was hard work, but very, very enjoyable, very satisfying. And I think collectively we produced a great book.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. It's a very hard work, but If it's really what you want, and obviously you have a lot of passion for what you've written about, I think, yeah, it's definitely worth it. But thank you very much for your kind words for it. We do appreciate that.
No, I think you should get that. I think it's right. It's due. So I think it's right to bring that into it, because it definitely is a big part of the journey of the development of that book. It's not just all about me. It's about that collaborative approach with you guys as well. And you do that very, very well.
Thank you. Yeah, we appreciate that. Okay, now let's go back to the book. And as you say in the book, you cover 10 essential rules for business. Unfortunately, we won't have time to go over all of the rules
All of the
today,
rules.
but I mean, people can buy the book to do that. But let's go over at least some of those rules, starting with the first one, which is setting the meeting momentum. So, what do you mean by that, Kevin?
Yeah, well, you're right to start here. Although the first three chapters are quite procedural and very basic, and some people who are experienced business leaders, I might add, might look at those first three chapters and think, well, kind of, yeah, okay, well, we're doing this, but then not everybody is. So it was important to get it down. And you do need to begin at the beginning, because the meeting momentum is, if for me, I've created what's called a leadership model operating system. And the meeting momentum sits firmly at the base as the foundation of that operating system. You've got to get this right, and then everything else can flourish and flow through. And why is it, what is it, and why is it important? Well, as somebody gets into a new leadership role, or if somebody sets up a new business, it's a fantastic time for most people. They really enjoy it, because you get this collaborative energy with your first, what I call your first hand team. In my book, I call it the power team, because it is like that. You've got this four or five people that you're bouncing off each other. You've got this cohesive energy, and you're really going 19 to the dozen to make massive improvements and development and grow a business, or in the team, grow your project or whatever you're dealing with. And it's very, very enjoyable. And actually, I personally experienced this, which I mentioned in the book, that I found it hard to come away from that. It was so enjoyable, because, just bouncing off each other, that meeting-free environment, it was very liberating, particularly for me, having come from a corporate background. But the reality of it is, at some point, we do have to stop in our tracks, and we have to put some structure around how we communicate. Because as the workforce gets wider, you get past 15 or 20 people. And that kind of depends what your business is. If it's 15 people in one room, not perhaps so early, but if it's 15 people dispersed across multi-locations, definitely. But at any point, at some point, we all need to create a more structured way of communicating with our team collectively. And the meeting momentum is the process for doing that. Now, meetings have a very bad reputation in business literature. I'm sure you've read plenty of the articles yourself. You've got people like Jane Thier, who used to be a columnist for Fortune, who called meetings productivity killers. Her strap line was that meeting should have been an email. And I know exactly what she means. I've sat in countless meetings that I've walked out of that and thought, we could have just done that with some written communication and some collaboration, one-on-one around the office. So, you've got that angle of it. But you've also got people like Dr. Stephen Rogelberg, who I mention in the book, who has written a whole book about meeting effectiveness. And effectively, if you look at his thesis, there's three things. Most businesses don't apply any training to the way meetings should be run. They don't have any kind of accountability as to what they're achieving. And no one person at any given time is normally owning the outcomes of the meetings. So we need to create this structure to make sure that meetings are effective. Now, there's lots of thought processes out there about this. I refer to Gino Wickman and Traction in my book, but there's lots of other examples of that. And essentially, the structure needs to be annual meeting, quarterly meeting or 90-day meetings, and weekly meetings. The annual meeting, very quickly, is the overarching plan of what we want to achieve this year. The reason we break it down into 90-day quarterly windows is because it's a lot easier for people to be accountable for change, making developments or changes over a 90-day window than it is on a weekly basis. In a nice 90-day framework, it's a comfortable time to get progress, to get transition. So we break the year down into four 90-day windows. The weekly meeting is really then just a stop check. And I use a football analogy for this. If a coaching team have got a game plan for a football game or a rugby game or as a cricket match, they'll have a match strategy. That's the first thing. So that, if you like, is the annual plan. They'll review that each individual game because obviously each game might be different. They review it at the beginning of the game, at half time often, as changes evolve. And also they'll probably review it at the end of the game depending to see how well it went. The stuff they're doing on the touch line is like the weekly meetings. It's they've got their iPads and they're on the hop. They're making changes on the hop because, as in the real world of commerce, we can have all these annual plans, we can have these quarterly objectives, but in real terms, there's things that happen in life that we're not expecting, and we have to make changes or modifications to represent that. So really, the weekly meeting then only becomes a checkpoint for what we're expecting to be talking about in more depth when we meet again at the next 90 days. So that's kind of a basic structure, meeting infrastructure that creates momentum. And the final piece of the jigsaw is the accountability and the ownership. And that's where the chairperson's role is really important. And there isn't enough training. Stephen Ruggleboo's right. There isn't enough training about this because it's almost like chairing a meeting is not just a case of following agenda. It's reading the room. It's sensing people's individual levels of interest or dynamics, the dynamic in the room, and making sure that they drive the momentum of that meeting forward by getting everybody involved. They should be reevaluating that meeting at the end of the process and asking everybody who attended whether they felt they'd been heard, whether they felt there were productive outcomes, so that he can measure and score that as we go on. So he creates some accountability and ownership about the whole process. So that in effect is a structured meeting momentum that is the foundation then for everything else that we talk about in the book to flow through.
Very interesting. I think what you're saying about being able to communicate effectively, it's the foundation for every successful business. And I know in the book you're talking about small and medium businesses especially. And we all know how easy it is to communicate when you've got a few people, but then once
Yeah.
that grows, what happens? It
Yeah.
becomes very difficult.
Yeah. Definitely. And that's invariably that's where things start to go a little bit wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and now I'm going to skip to the fourth rule, which is about boosting your brain power. So that sounds very interesting. So could you tell us a bit more?
Yeah, again, this is quite a well-rehearsed thesis. It's out there in the marketplace. So again, I'm also bringing it into the book because it is an integral part of the onward journey in the book. So we have to get this right again before we can move on to some of the other aspects. So some people might already be at this place because it's fairly well broadcast, but equally there'll be lots of people that it will be brand new to. But yeah, brain power is a really interesting aspect. And the first thing to say, I guess, is that everything in the book is about building winning teams. So it's all about collaboration and the collective. But at this chapter, we just stop for a second and we start to look inwardly at ourselves and our own personal development, and then equally encouraging our team to do the same for themselves as well. So this is now shifting into a much more introspective inward look. We're for the first time starting to do that. So we need to work on ourselves now. Often, in business and work, time is always a pressure, isn't it? We've never got enough time. We've always got a to-do list longer than we can fit into any given day, and so on and so forth. So time pressures become very sensitive. And if you've got somebody like me, then bringing in a book that says, actually, if you do these things, it will get better. You've kind of got to do those things first. And that puts more impact on time. So I wanted to deal with the time pressures. It's interesting, isn't it, that we're going through over the last 18 months or so, we've gone through this bell curve of what I call an industrial revolution with artificial intelligence. It's come back, it's very much in everybody's sort of language nowadays. And for me, what artificial intelligence does is it gives a rebirth to a concept that was introduced to the business world in 1997 by a guy called Richard Koch, who created the 80-20 principle. He repurposed that from a guy called Alfredo Pareto, who originally was from Italy. And the concept simply was, believe it or not, that 80% of the land owned in Italy was owned by 20% of the population. So that's where the sort of 2080 thing came from. And what Richard cleverly did was took that into the business world and said, we should spend time doing those things that take up 20% of our time, but give us 80% outcomes and productivity. And there's a whole theory and process around that. Some people really buy into it. Some people maybe a little bit suspect of it, but that's there. And what artificial intelligence does is give that a whole new rebirth, because in fact, if we use artificial intelligence correctly, that will give us the opportunity to take away some of the mundane things that we spend our time doing, and spending more time doing the strategic development work that artificial intelligence actually can't do. So it's a really interesting concept. But to be able to do that, we have to optimize how our brain works. So we really, the brain is the operating model of our existence. You know, it's the one thing that makes everything work together. We all know that. But there's three elements to making sure that we have a good, healthy, productive brain. That is sleep, controlling our sleep patterns, what we eat, what we consume during the day and at what times of the day, and how much activity we can build into our routines. I guess what I wanted to do was compartmentalize the day into three areas. So the first area is what I call rest and relaxation, to make sure that we're giving ourselves a chance to get a good 7 to 8 hours of quality sleep every night. But preceding that, we need to wind down. Unfortunately, you know, it's quite a common scenario that people are still answering emails, WhatsApp messages, and doing work and stuff half an hour before they're going to bed. That isn't going to really get you into a good position for sleep. So you need to kind of protect your last 1 or 2 hours. Everybody's different, so there's no set pattern, but at least you need to protect that last hour, if nothing else. And what I mean by that is that you're not doing any work now. You're not really going on social media and scrolling through whatever you scroll through and activating your brain. You're allowing yourself to relax and wind down a little bit. Maybe take a hot shower, go to bed half an hour earlier than you intend to sleep, and just sit there and zone out, you know, and just chill for a bit, maybe listen to some music or read a book. So protect that last hour so you get that good quality sleep. So that's one aspect of it. What we eat, actually, there's a fascinating piece in the book that I've referred from a guy called Dr. Greg Wells. He's a physiotherapist. He's worked with Olympians for about 20 odd years. And he talks about diet very well in terms of what effect that has on our brain cells. And there's certain foods that ignite and energize our brain cells, and there's certain foods that put us to sleep. So we're all familiar, aren't we, that if you go out on a business lunch and you have a heavy carb lunch, the one thing you're trying to do that afternoon is probably find somewhere to go and have a nap, because you're just, you know, carbs just basically switch everything down and say, right, we're in sleep mode. So we should be doing that at the end of the day, not in the middle of the day. And eating high fiber foods and protein foods is a better way of activating the brain. So we look at that. And then finally, we don't all have to be gym buffs. We don't all have to be going to the gym every day or doing 5 mile runs every day. Just 15 minutes a day walking is proven to be beneficial to our brain health. So building some activity into the day. That's why you hear about Steve Jobs and his walking meetings, because the brain is actually functioning better when we're moving. So if we could have our quarterly meetings all standing up and walking around the room, probably be chaotic, right? But we'll probably be performing a lot better, because our brains, when we move, our brains are more activated. But yeah, that's probably a bit extreme, but definitely putting in ergonomic sit stand desks, so you can have the option, I'm going to sit for a bit, now I'm going to stand a bit and walk about on the spot while I'm working. All those sorts of little tips and tricks just to create a bit more activity to build into your day. These are all the things that give you brain power. These are all the things that make your brain more efficient. And if you're more efficient, and if you compartmentalize your day into these three zones, you're more likely then to achieve more, because your rest and relaxation gives you the energy for the next day. And you also allocate this 20% sort of high charge work focused area where you're working on stuff that you're really concentrating on. I'm going to talk a bit about that later. And then what goes on in between that are just automated processes. that we operate with every single day. So it's compartmentalizing those three things is going to give you a better structure to the day, but also make the brain a healthier place.
Yeah, it's amazing how those little choices can make a huge difference to our work life, even though I think a lot of leaders are probably not thinking how my sleeping and, well, probably not so much the sleeping, but my eating is affecting my work, which is quite amazing. But I didn't know the 80-20 rule was coming from from there, which was quite interesting.
What, from Italy?
Yeah, no, it's the first time I hear it. Now I'll move to the rule number six, which is about launching the business for the long term. So we know how a lot of people are focused on, well, short-term goals and objectives, and it's quite difficult for a lot of us to think in the long term. So how can we do that?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, Mikel Arteta beat my beloved Tottenham Hotspurs yesterday 4-1. It wasn't a very, very pleasant watch. But I know Martin's an Arsenal fan, so I was pleased for him anyway. But Mikel Arteta, when he went to Arsenal in 2019, 2020, he was so unpopular. I mean, the fans were all riling against him. All the journalists and everybody were all saying, this guy can't do the job. He hasn't got enough experience. He was a prodigy of Pep from Man City. And he was facing a really difficult time. He didn't have a very good successful season that season. Neither did he have a successful, for Arsenal anyway, a very successful season the following season. He was constantly being hounded by the press and pundits and so on and so forth and supporters. And he stood there stoically on every occasion and just said, we're following the process. We're just going to follow the process. And now, of course, we all see the process. Even people who aren't Arsenal fans can see that process. You know, they've had a progressive journey over 5 or 6 years. Every season they've got that little bit better. Okay, they've got close and they just missed the mark, but they've picked themselves up and gone again. And they're following, and you can see that process they're following. And this could be the season where they realise those dreams that he probably put down 5 or 6 years ago of either getting a Champions League Cup or winning the Premier League title. So there's a really good football analogy of somebody who set a process. Despite all the protestations, he stuck to his process and he said, no, we're going to follow the process. So we talked about the annual plan in the meeting momentum, and that's effectively the process. That's what we're saying. But it also comes from something else called a 3 or a 5 or a 10-year plan. So a business needs to have a roadmap at some point. We need to create a roadmap for the business of what we think it should look like. Now, the thing, Taya, with roadmaps, even your own personal roadmaps, and I've experienced this many times, is that the longer it is in the future, the more likely it is it's going to flex and bend, right? Because we're not all going to just live this maze of life and everything's going to go exactly as we planned it when we were 21 years old. You know, it just doesn't work that way. But nevertheless, it's still good to have a pathway. You can change that pathway and be flexible and bend with it. But in a business, the first thing you should at least have is, I would say, a 3-year, ideally a 5-year plan of what that business should be looking like in 5 years from now. So why do we do that? Well, it gives you motivation for a start, because if you can see the bigger picture, if you can see what your business is going to look potentially like in advertorial terms in 5 years' time, it's going to give you that motivation and drive when things do get tough. So, you know, building that roadmap gives you that sort of purpose and direction. So in the 12-month plan, we start building for the long term. And what we do is we start with 5 questions. The first one is, what's our mission? What's our promise? You know, what is it? What's our purpose? What are we as a business? What do we stand for? The second question is then, okay, so why is that different? Why is that going to be different to anybody else doing a similar thing? So understanding what our difference is. And then we sit down from there. And the third question is, we draft up, what is our 3 to 5 year plan? And we draw out a roadmap. Now, that roadmap will only be headlines. It could be things like, how much turnover do we want to have by year 2 and 3, 4 and 5? What's our market share? What do we want that to be? What headcount do we need to be able to achieve that? So just really 4 or 5 key headline numbers that give you a marker, if you like, that you can start working toward. And then the final question out of the five is, okay, so what are the values? What do we stand for? What are our core values to make that happen? Because we all have to have that shared vision. It's a 12-month project. So we talk about it in the first annual meeting. We call it the kickoff meeting in the book, where we put these processes in place and we go off for 12 months and we set up focus groups to create shared vision. So we get everybody involved with it. We have people from different aspects of the business coming to the focus groups and representing their section of the business to create this collective focused objective of getting to that shared vision and strategy for the future that everybody can own and buy into. Stephen Covey was probably one of the first people to make this a famous concept in terms of shared vision and values, with his Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. And he talks in that book principally about people who operate with integrity and maturity are going to have a far greater chance of being able to work with shared values and vision in a business. So we work on those seven rules. And I've created seven principles similar to the rules that work in the 10-10-minute rules to align people to have a growth mindset is the first element. And then the second one is to work collaboratively and create winning team cultures. So we use those seven rules to develop that integrity and maturity in the individuals within the team. When I was at Palace, quick story, because I know I'm going on a bit. When I was at Palace, there was a really important analogy that the one thing in those 10 years that I realized very quickly was that the only time we were ever successful as a club was when the boardroom, the training ground, and the dressing room were all in sync with each other. As soon as only one of those elements, it could be the training ground was in tune with the boardroom, but the players weren't in tune with the training ground, or it could be the training ground were in tune with the players, but no, everybody was ignoring the boardroom. If there was any disconnect in any of that tri-party relationship, it would never work. But as soon as that all fused together and worked, wow, you're on a winning streak like you wouldn't imagine because everybody's on the same page. So yeah, that's effectively the purpose and the reason why we have to have that long-term plan and get everybody involved in that journey.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I'm not going to ask you about the rest of the rules, Kevin, but of course our listeners, they can grab the book and we'll read more about those three we've discussed and all the other seven rules that you cover in the book. But I think an important question here is how can leaders assess how well they're doing in each of those 10 rules?
So the 10-10 minute rules in that process, we do have this tool which we call the 10-minute rule. It's something that happens is meant to happen on a daily basis. The 10-10 minute rules, there I break it down. There's two elements of it. One is behavioral, one is functional. So a behavioral 10-minute rule is changing something behaviorally within ourselves. So it's very introspective. To give you an example of that, let's just say we want to improve our quality relaxation before we try to attain 7 to 8 hours of good quality sleep. We kind of need to build something into our day that creates a demarcation from the everyday subconscious existence of routine habitual behavior into a conscious existence of purposefully trying to relax. And not look at our WhatsApp, not look at our phones, not look at our emails and so on, or even do any work. So that might be we introduce ourselves to a 10-minute walk, because that then gives us another spin-off on something else, which is about getting some more activity into our day. So building that behavioral 10-minute walking is a behavioral improvement that we use the 10-10-minute rules to create that, to make that happen on a daily basis. The functional ones are very much about the interactive bit. So it might be that we want to spend 10 minutes a day with one of our team members to establish how they're getting on with their particular work. So that then becomes a functional process. The actual rule itself is behavioral in the sense that it happens every day, but what you talk about in the 10 minutes becomes functional, so we can swap that out. But it's in those processes that you can get that peer review. And that sort of subordinate review as well as to how they're getting on with their particular tasks and exercises. So that kind of shows you how leaders can assess other people, be it peers or subordinates, team members, and how they're progressing. It also gives you that really important aspect, and I like this, of the 180 degree feedback. So if you and I were doing it, for example, we might be sitting down together, but I might be saying to you, well, actually, Taylor, I've done this because of X, Y, Z, and you're going, well, I've done it this way because of what? And we're learning from each other. So we're getting this 180 degree return on it. So it's really healthy. And then in terms of how do you assess or measure that? Well, we build into that 10-minute rule performance analysis, which is about having a daily scoring mechanism as to how we're progressing. So in a sense, we're gonna go in more detail in a moment about what a 10-minute rule looks like. But in a sense, if we're scoring something every day, then we're watching how that score changes. It increases or it stays static. We're assessing whether what we're doing, this simple example of going for a walk every day, if we achieve that, then the score is going to go up. If we miss a few days, the score is going to start to decline again. So you get that self-analysis process going on within it as well. And it's all about just making small improvements in aspects of our approach to our work or our daily lives, our health and well-being.
Absolutely. And so you did mention the 10 minutes daily routine. So could you talk to us a little bit more about that, what it is exactly and how it helps you to develop your skills and improve them?
Yeah, sure. Okay. It's really interesting. It's nearly 100 years ago now that a guy called John Dewey, who was a psychologist, he made a fairly profound statement when he said that we don't learn from experience. We actually learn from reflecting on experience. Now, of course, he said a lot more than that, but I just picked that out because that then drives into what we're now doing. And it was actually all the way forward then into 1983 when industrialist Donald Shong, he wrote a book called The Reflective Practitioner. And in that book, he produced a product or a model, a blueprint, if you like, for self-analysis and improvement called The Reflective Model. And that, in essence, is what I base the 10-10-minute rule on, is this reflective model. There are four aspects to a reflective model. The first aspect is we frame. So we frame an issue or a behavior or an aspect of business. The second element is we create an action to improve on that. The third element is that we reflect on that action. And the fourth element is we then reframe our process. So it's frame, action, reflect, reframe. So how does that work in terms of the 10-10-minute rules? In terms of framing, what I advocate for is that we look at our business and we look at aspects of our business. Now, in the book, we obviously break it down into 10 core pillars of business, and each chapter looks at one aspect. But also in any areas of our business, we might look at our business and say, okay, let's get together as a group of five or six senior leaders or departmental team members, and let's get down, what does best practice look like? And the way we do that is we evaluate that by creating 10 first statement, written in the first statement, oh, sorry, in the first person statements that describe what best practice looks like for that particular function within the business. Once we've established those 10 best practices, we've kind of framed what we're looking for as the optimum performance in that area. The next thing we look to do is we look to then assess our own individual competence or abilities in those 10 best practice statements. So we need to honestly self-appraise ourselves. And I use a three-point scoring system of A, B, or C, which is A, this is something I already do pretty well. I'm quite comfortable with that. B, this is not something really that I enjoy doing. It's just not, it's not really my thing. If it were me, it'd be to do anything to do with maths. But it's just not my thing. Or C, this is something that I do like doing, but actually I'd like to be able to do it a little bit better. The B stuff, the B statements, that's something we'll park and we'll look to, as we build our team, start finding people who have better skills suited to those areas over the course of time. So we start delegating and elevating those tasks. The C stuff is what we then start to look at introspectively at ourselves and say, okay, what can I now do? So we make, and this is now the action part of the process, what can I now do to make a positive affirmation to make that process a little bit better for myself? So it's very much self-analysis, but also self-improvement. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to commit every day over a 10-minute period to do this, which is going to make me better at doing that particular thing. So I'll give you a really, really obvious one. Most people who come out of meetings have got things to get done and they go back to the meeting, even in 90 days' time. Sometimes go, I still haven't found time to do that. We know that's a weakness. So we create a mechanism of a 10-minute daily routine of looking at our to-dos and formulating a plan of action that we can check on a daily basis. So it just creates that forward momentum trajectory, if you like. So that's the action part of it. The reflection is then the scoring that we just spoke about. So we score that every day, 1 to 10. We start off with a score that we've given ourselves on the self-assessment, might be at a 4. And what we're looking to do is see that score gradually drift into a higher bracket. And by doing this every single day, we're reframing our approach to how we work. We're actually changing the way our brain works through a process called neuroplasticity. So these repeated habitual things that we're doing every day are shifting. We're going to talk about that in a bit, I think. But we're shifting things from what were something we had to consciously concentrate on into the subconscious. So we're changing the way our brain works. And we get to a point where if we're constantly every day scoring an 8 or a 9, we know really we don't probably need to purposefully pay attention to that anymore because it's become something we automatically do. So we can drop that and we can introduce something else. So that's a very sort of very broad outline of a 10-minute rule.
Yeah, fascinating. And what's very interesting to me in the book, you say that we should be prioritizing just one area of improvements to work on at a time. So why is that? Why can't we work on a few things simultaneously?
Yeah, I think because the first thing to say is that the book can be read in about, I think, 3, 3.5 hours. If you read it page to page, if you bought it at an airport and read it on a plane. Hopefully some people will. you could probably read it before the flight's finished. It's about a 3 hour, 3, 3.5 hour read, I think. I actually recommend in the book that you read it over at least a process of 12 days by only reading one chapter a day. And there's a reason for that in the book that explains that. So you could read it over 3 hours, you could read it over 12 days. But what's really important is that this was never designed to be something that could be fixed in 3 hours or 12 hours. This was something that's intended to take a 9-10 month process. You know, my 10-pillar program is something that I sell into businesses over a 10-month period or a 12-month period, 10 months of the 12 months. And it's that sort of 10-month window that you're working on. So, you know, we've got plenty of time for this. And why is it important that we only deal with one area at a time? So if you were working on one rule at a time and you took one rule a month to work on, that would take you 10 months. Why is that important and why does it take so long? Well, effectively what we're trying to do is we're trying to shift behaviours from the conscious into the subconscious. So when we talked about brain power, I talked about compartmentalizing our day. And in that, we operate in areas where we're concentrating on what we're doing. This is when we're doing our strategic work, and we might only apply 20, 30, 40% of our day to that. And the rest of the time, we're just doing our routine stuff. And when we're in that zone, we're using a lot of brain power. And one of the things that's really important about focused, directive work, strategic work, is that we only single task. That's why you have to shut the room off from interruption. You have to turn your phone off. You have to turn off your email so you're not getting interrupted. So you can just focus on getting this particular task done without any interruption. And that's because the brain, it's exhausting. If we start multitasking when you're using that amount of energy up in your brain, you're going to wipe yourself out fairly quickly because every time you shift from one thing to another, you're using that unnecessary energy in the brain and you just won't get the maximum impact out of that quality time. So that's the focused conscious state, if you like. They're called medium beta brain waves in scientific terms. We're operating the medium beta brain waves that create this focused, you must have experienced that, Taya, that sort of focused, I'm really going to get this article done. I'm really, you know, I don't want to be interrupted. I'm just on this. The rest of the day, which, believe it or not, represents about 95% of your time, you're operating in what we call the subconscious state. Now, the subconscious state is just auto processes, how we drink, how we breathe, how we talk. how we walk, they're all automated processes. And there's a plethora of it, of exercises and things that we do every single day that are just automatic processes. You probably, if you drove to work this morning, you probably don't even remember the journey. It's just, you're on autopilot, aren't you, when you do it? And it's all of that is going on in what we call the subconscious. It's using up much less brain energy because obviously it's all working in that subconscious automated process. So when we take a 10-minute rule, what we've got to do is we've got to start putting it in the conscious state to make a conscious awareness, an effort to make sure that we get that done. And then we repeat that every day until we shift it into effectively a subconscious action or activity. And then it becomes a normal part of our day and we don't really have to even think about it anymore. Well, you can only actually do that with one thing at a time. If you try to multiply that over two or three different things, it's just not going to work. It has to be specifically focused on, I'm going to get this fixed, then we'll move on to the next thing, and so on and so forth. So that in a very long, long, long answer is why you can only work on one thing at a time.
Yeah, but it absolutely makes sense. I mean, I've read some research on why we're so bad at multitasking, although we like to think we are not. But yeah, it takes a lot of brain energy to focus on improving one thing. Right. So, Kevin, I've got one final question for this very interesting conversation. And it is, why do you think self-development is so essential for every leader?
I think the first thing to say is that standing still shouldn't be an option for any of us. You know, we all want to be better versions of ourselves, if we're honest. So, you know, if we want to get the edge on the way we run our business, if we want to get the edge on the way we run our team as a leader in a leadership team, we've got to be looking at self-development and self-improvement. But also, self-development and self-improvement, there's lots of other side hustle benefits that you get from that. You get greater resilience, you get healthier relationships, and you get a much happier life. So it's all conducive toward achieving that. I mentioned the beginning of the call, I think, about my journey at Crystal Palace and this other element of, so you've got leadership mindset, business operating systems, and there's this other area of performance analysis. I first came across this in 2003 when a company who were the founding company of sports science called Prozone came into Crystal Palace and they said, hey, look, guys, what we're going to do is we're going to film the match this weekend. And I went, well, great, we do that anyway. So I don't know what's new there. And then they rocked up on Monday morning. And with that video, it'd been through the software, their Prozone software, and come back with all these stats and all this data about every individual player in that match, how many yards they'd run, how many times they crossed the ball, how many times the ball went into the box, how many shots at goal, you know, and then defensive mechanisms and all those stats and data all being delivered to the coaching staff on a Monday morning for the match that was played that Saturday. And what they were doing is they were automating the self-analysis process of how the team collectively were playing or performing in that match. Now, in 2003, this was fairly dynamic. Of course, nowadays, if you watch sport on television, the screens are blazing with this stuff. It's part of our everyday entertainment experience. But in those days, it was a real turning point in giving teams that leverage to perform better. So we parked that. I thought, great, this is working really well. That was the season. Funny enough, we actually got promoted to the Premier League as well, which was probably not a coincidence. And then I was running my own business in 2012, and I was just starting to get into that point now where I was losing a little bit of control over the wider team that we talked about at the beginning of the call. Anyway, I rocked up at my son's school. He was about to go into his GCSE and A levels, and they brought in a psychological firm who were applying these same performance self-analysis behaviors to the way that the students were studying and revising for their GCSEs and A levels. And in actual fact, they're still at that school now, I believe, and they basically managed to get a 10% improvement almost straight away on the percentile grades of the children's scores up into the, you know, the A's and the A stars. And I thought, oh right, okay, so this performance analysis, that's what we were doing at Palace. And that's when the light bulb came on, and I thought, oh yeah, that's why we need to apply this into the business world. And therefore, that whole self-analysis is a really important part of self-development. In the 10-10-minute rules, we use that. It's the same self-analysis techniques that are used by people that are at the top of their field, particularly in sport and science arenas and so on and so forth. And it really worked for me as well. It helped me to consolidate the business. It's not just enough about learning about business operating systems and putting them in place. It's not just enough about taking people into a room and saying, this is what you need to be a leader, and giving them a few key points and keynote speakers and some slideshows. And then they walk out the room and go, oh, I'm a leader now. Doesn't work that way. We have to habitualize the routines. We have to put in self-analysis processes to make sure we shift those things into becoming actualities and not just theory. So that was the third element of it. So self-development is really important, but also how we apply that and make sure we get the full package is also, for me, very, very important. And it comes from a place that I have great personal experience from, where I've been fortunate to get.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Kevin, for this very insightful conversation today. I really enjoyed it. And of course, I encourage our listeners to grab a copy of the 10-10-minute rules to read more of the rules, the 10-minute daily routine and your insights. But thank you very much again for your time today.
No, well, thanks. Thanks for giving me the opportunity. Have a good day.
Absolutely, you need to. Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you keep an eye on our social media at Lit Publishing on LinkedIn, X, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. See you next time on Lit Radio Podcast.